Thank you so much. You can bring the slideshow up. Thank you. So today we're going to try and get through seven churches, which is 2.5 chapters. And we did send a WhatsApp this week that today's service would end at 12. Did you get that? So we're going to take the first while just to read all the verses, and then we're going to go through it book by book. It's actually been a mission to try and cover this in one message, the seven churches. But just a recap, and I'm just going to go for it. You ready? A recap from last week for those of you who weren't here, that there are certain lenses or approaches that people can take towards the book of Revelation. And when you read something you've never heard before, it's probably not something that you discovered. I'd hate to break it to you. People and theologians have in the East and the West Church and all around the world have been trying to get a handle on the book of Revelation for centuries. And I don't have very encouraging news for you today, but you're probably not going to crack it. There's part of a mystery, but one of the things that's important is to understand the lens by which, in other words, the approach by which people see the book of Revelation. And there were five lenses. They should be coming up behind me. The first one was some people see Revelation as written specifically in and for just that historical context in the first century. And this is called a preterist view for the theologians out you. So everything John writes, including the visions and the dreams and the end of time, is simply about the seven churches that we know were geographical churches that were going through incredible tribulation. And so the beast is Rome, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to know more, you can listen to last week's message. The second view is the historicist view. So they admit that the first three chapters, in other words, the message to the seven churches, was specifically for the historical context. But then from chapter 4 all the way through to 22 is a historical roadmap for human and church history and world history until the second coming. So they take basically from Revelation chapter 4, you look at how history will unfold from that time. The third one sounds similar, but it's not that similar. It's called the futurist view, which basically, also Revelation chapter 4, this is when John takes has a vision up into the heavens. From chapter 4 to 22 is all about the end of the end, just before the second coming. Do you get that? So the historicist view is you could look at Revelation 4 and you could see the signs in church history all the way from John's time all the way to now. They would say that it's a chronological roadmap of history. The futurist view says from Revelation 4 up to just before the second coming of Christ is not about the history of the church in those years since John wrote. It's specifically about the end of the end, just before Jesus returns. Then there is the symbolical view, which is related to the nature of the text, which is apocalyptic writing. And so we spoke a lot about that last week, how apocalyptic writing was common in the day. We can see the book of Daniel, Ezekiel. There's also 1 Enoch, which isn't canonical, but it is quoted by Jude. These were styles of writing that were normally quite grandeur. They were visions. The way I explained it last week for the Arbs among us is basically they would write like they were on an acid trip, anyone who's ever done drugs before. Not that they were on an acid trip, but it was dreams and visions and revelations and the end of time and all these outs of body. But it's a kind of literature. And so we do ourselves a disservice if we look at the book of Revelation without understanding the literary style. We talked about numbers with symbolism. A lot of times there's numbers, and so these questions will come up. And you're going to be very disappointed in this series, I'm just warning you, because you're all expecting me to tell you what to believe. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to present to you the different views and the questions and the mysteries, and together we're going to try and find a way that we can go forward and understand this. And so does the number 7 really mean 7 churches, or is it the fullness of God? Does the 1,000 years a literal 1,000-year reign? Is Satan chained with a literal chain and a lock and a key? Are 7 years literal 7 years? Are there actually going to be demon-like locusts that are going to come on the earth. And these are, they're not wrong or right answers to this, but if you don't understand apocalyptic literature, you're going to get a little bit confused in the book of Revelation. The last approach was the pastoral, where the book of Revelation and the symbols have multiple layers. So Revelation is rooted in the first century, it is repeated in history, and it is culminating in the end. And the attitude that we approach the book of Revelation is important. We approach it with humility, and I think that can be a problem sometimes when people have very dogmatic views on the book of Revelation, on how it's all going to end, on whether you're mid, post, pre-tribulation, pre-millennial, what is your view, and it can become a source of division. We will not be that kind of church. You're welcome to have your opinions, but we don't want you to force your opinions on other people. So humility needs to be an absolute character of the way that we face us. Also wisdom, I've already explained that, apocalyptic literature, because what unites us is Christ, not my view on whether I'm going to fly up and be with Jesus at this time or that time. The only thing that unites us, Kevin, you did well today, well done. The only thing that unites us is our Christology, not our eschatology. And just a shout out to Tina. We have a bird that obviously eats all day because it poos just all along here. Tina cleaned up all that bird poo this morning. Where's Tina? Let's give her a hand. Thank you, Tina. And so those are the things I covered last week. Revelation 1 verse 10. On the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit. So he's having a vision. Interesting, the Lord's day. I won't talk about that now, but remember the Lord's Day has symbolism in the Old Testament and the New. And I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, which said, write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Write therefore what you have seen, what it is now and what will take place later. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels. The Greek there can also be translated messengers. So some of your versions might have messengers, some might have angels of the seven churches. And the seven lampstands are the churches. And so what we're going to do is just summarize the seven churches. And so the way I've approached it is I've looked at some of the cultural issues, external factors that the churches were facing, which are actually quite generic to most of them. Then I'm going to pick up one or two churches that had specific issues that were not pertinent to the others, and then hopefully we'll come to some conclusions. First of all, is there a map behind me? Let's go to the map. There we go. Those are the geographical location of the churches. They were on a Roman postal route, so we know that they existed, and there actually is archaeological evidence to prove that those churches existed. So we know specifically that John was actually writing to physical churches. Because it was on a kind of Roman postal route, it could have been a circuit. John could have been the circuit preacher. He was obviously well known. There's a little bit of lack of clarity. Some fighting about which John it is. I'm sticking with John, the apostle. And so he would have been well known, and he was a shepherd probably, or an overseer, or what, like an apostle to these seven churches. Okay, and so the structure behind all the words to the seven churches is important. First of all, there is a revelation of an attribute of Jesus. So often in the church, he will greet, Jesus will speak, and there'll be sometimes it seems random revelation of himself. But the interesting thing is every revelation of himself to that specific church is related to the issue that they are facing. Isn't that interesting? And so there is a revelation of the attribute of Jesus to all the churches. There is a commendation, in other words, what you're doing well. I think maybe one or two churches don't get any commendation. There is a criticism, there is an instruction, and there is a reward. And so that's the basic structure. Let's go with the church's external and cultural problems of idolatry and deception. Now, in this culture, it's hard for us to understand, but it is not the same as the culture we live in, which in essence is still quite Christian. The Roman Empire and first century BC was a time of where we have Western culture as our kind of basic belief system. This was a time of paganism, of temple worship, of idolatry, and so it was very different to the message of the gospel. And so I'm going to read to you a few places where they worshipped. These were not just places of worship. These were not like Mercy, where you come in at 9:30 and you leave at 11 or 11:30 and you're done with church for the week. These were often in central marketplaces. The whole life and culture was around these temples. Going to temple wasn't just going to temple to pray. Going to temple with most of them was to indulge in sexual immorality and orgies. That's why often you'll hear in the Old Testament that there were prostitutes that were associated with temples. They were also the life center of the towns. And so a temple wasn't just a temple. This is what I'm trying to explain to you. It wasn't just a temple. It was the heartbeat or the backbone or the pillar of the culture. It was a place for meeting. It was a place for fellowship. It was a place for eating. It was a place for selling. And so these churches, remember, they are new. The Christian gospel is new, and so there's external problems of idolatry, deception, and temple worship that many of those seven churches are facing. The first one was the temple of Artemis or Diana in Ephesus. Now, my memory might be incorrect, but I think I'm right in saying this. To give you an idea. Of what this pagan, idolatrous religious system was, is the god was covered in breasts from head to toe. And that wasn't for having children. It was regarded as a fertility cult. It was a highly sexualized religion, engaging in many things that I won't repeat here. And it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. That's why, you know, when Paul planted the church there was a silversmith called Demetrius who actually rose people up against him because he was causing problems with the trade that they have because he was selling idols of this temple. And so there was external. Ephesus was facing this temple of Artemis or Diana, a fertility and sex cult. The second thing that we see churches are facing, and this is in Smyrna, is the Jewish synagogue of Satan in Smyrna, anti-Christian synagogue. Now, synagogue is once used in the New Testament for the word church. I think it's in James 2, verse 2. But all other times it's used for a synagogue. So these weren't kind of people, genuine Israelite believers in Yahweh. They had become a hate-filled, almost Jewish cult that was opposing the message of the gospel in Smyrna. Eusebius, writing in, he's a church historian, says this about the Jews of Smyrna. Jews of Smyrna were instrumental in Polycarp. Does anyone know who Polycarp is? He was one of the great earliest church fathers who was very well known, and he was burnt at the stake. The Jews of Smyrna were instrumental in burning Polycarp at the stake. When the mob began gathering firewood, the Jews actually ran around, this synagogue actually ran around getting fuel to burn this heretic. This is why John says it is the synagogue of Satan. And what we see here, we will see throughout the book of Revelation, where we might see a physical thing that actually a church or a synagogue or something that actually might have been intentioned for good, but Satan has entered into it and into the hearts of the people. And so what you have is you have a physical building or people that are purporting to be something, but they're actually a synagogue of Satan. Now, before we say, oh, yeah, because it was Jewish, no, that same thing can happen in churches. That same thing can happen in any organization where there is an anti-Christian, anti-people, anti-loving people, anti-loving God approach. But I believe, from what I see here, is that Satan actually infiltrates governments, he infiltrates communities, he infiltrates community leaders, he infiltrates churches, he infiltrates other worship places, and he actually gets a hold on those places, and he begins to do his work through those people. And often those people think that what they're doing is in the name of God. This is the lesson we see from the synagogue of Satan. Thirdly, in Pergamum, we have the God of Asclepius. Am I going too quickly or are you catching? You with me? Okay, I've got a lot to cover. The God of Asclepius, okay, how many of you, when you go, any of you get picked up by an ambulance lately? Don't put up your hands. Have you ever noticed what the sign on the side of the ambulance is or the sign on the side of the hospital? What is that? It's a serpent with a stick. Why is that? Well, now you're about to find out. Pastors are also history teachers. That comes from this, the God of Asclepius. Look at 2 verse 13. I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. Yet you remain true to my name. You do not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives. We see that again, where Satan lives. Now, Asclepius was regarded as a Greek deity who was the son of Apollo. He was also regarded as the god of healing. And so in Pergamum, we had a worship of the god of Asclepius, but he was not considered a fertility cult like the temple Diana. He was considered the one who would bring life, also carry death, but would bring life. Let me tell you something. You would not want to go to one of their hospitals. Not that they had hospitals. They called them healing rooms, because the way they healed is they believed snakes had special powers, and so they used to release snakes into the rooms to bring healing because they believed that it carried the power of healing within them. I'm not lying. His daughter, and you might be familiar with the word that, you know, when you tell your child to shower. Why? Because you need to be hygienic. Well, the daughter, according to this Greek mythology, was Hygieia, where we get the word hygiene. And so that modern-day symbol is actually a symbol of the god of Asclepius. Now, please, don't be crazy. Don't, like, next time you're dying, an ambulance arrives, tell your husband, just go see, is there a snake on the window? Because if there is, I'm not getting in because Satan is there. That's not my point. My point is that this is what the Christians were facing. And originally, to take a Hippocratic oath, let me quote, you had to say, I swear by Apollo the physician, by Asclepius, and by Hygieia and Panica, and by all the gods. And so you understand that the context that Christians are living in is not the same context that we have today. But our kind of healing, snake healing rooms, and our kind of gatherings are a little bit less obvious than we see here, but they are definitely alive and well. And so this is what they were facing. Then some of them were facing the teaching of Balaam. Pergamum, chapter 2, verse 14. Balaam's story is in Numbers 22 to 24. To summarize, Balaam was a bit of a people pleaser. He wanted to also use his prophetic gift, or how can I categorize it? He wanted to go into ministry to become some apostle with a certain name, to drive a nice car and preach about the blessed life. Okay, that's not really in the Bible. That's just my analysis of him. He also, one of his ideas was to entice the Jewish men to sin by sending pretty Moabite women. And so it's a sensual thing. It's an enticing thing. It's a deception thing. And it's a connection between preaching the message and wanting money out of it and using it for money or for sexual immorality. Thankfully, we've had no recent scandals in the church for the last 10 years. So Christianity in the West is alive and well. The other false teaching was of the Nicolaitans. Some say this was related to one of the Christians that are mentioned in Acts chapter 6, verse 5, called Nicholas, and regard him as a lapsed Christian. So followed Christ and then had turned his backs. And basically, what Nicolaitans did is what we would call syncretism. So I see this a lot in the rural areas where you will go to a pastor. We actually had a situation with one of our pastors last year where there's a syncretism between following Sangomas and and make sure that the ancestors are happy, keeping your beads on and around your waist, and going through slaughtering the cat just to keep the ancestors happy. But actually, we are Christians, so we also go to church, and we want to keep Jesus happy. I call it the fruit salad effect. It's the fruit bowl. So syncretism is trying to join things that shouldn't be joined because you want to worship both of those things. So this is what the Nicolaitans did. Idol worship, he talked about food sacrifice to idols and sexual immorality, which, interestingly enough, is the Greek word pornea. You ever heard that word? The last external factor, I know it's hot, guys, we're getting there. The last external factor that they were facing was a false prophetess called Jezebel in Thyatira. And this is chapter 2 from verse 18 to 29. And so there was someone who had come into their church, and there is some historical evidence for this, about a Christian prophetess living in Thyatira who deceived countless Christians with false teachings and so-called prophecies. And what was happening in Thyatira was, because it was so difficult to be a Christian, she was basically saying, hey, you can go to the temple prostitute, you can worship at the pagan temple, you can keep doing those things, but you can also be a Christian. And then she would bring these utterances or prophecies that they would regard as revelation, and thereby deceiving countless Christians to follow her way. There was also a sense of a sexual component that was attached to Jezebel. Look at verse 20. You tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophet. By her teaching, she misleads my servants into sexual immorality and eating of food sacrificed to idols. And you have not learned, he's saying, this is further on, Satan's so-called dark secrets. So she came with a teaching that was, number one, incorrect theology. Listen, I'll tell you what, the best false teaching is something that's just a little bit off the truth, because it's so hard to discern. The best false teaching, a little bit of the truth. That's what she was doing. Then she was using the spiritual gifts, and we've seen this in the charismatic church time and time again, where people use their gifts to prophesy and manipulate people. You have to make very sure that if you're saying something, you're prophesying, that your heart is true, and you don't have an agenda. Do you know how when I was younger, we were in this very young, we all had this very charismatic church, do you know how many men got prophecies for a woman that God had told them they were going to marry them? Hundreds. It's dangerous. Very dangerous. And so Jezebel's not just a person. Yeah, she's a person, but Jezebel's a spirit. We've heard about this. Jezebel's a spirit. It's someone who comes in, or it's a teaching that comes in that's close to the truth, but a little bit off. And is also someone who claims to be a prophet or hear from God. Basically, a higher revelation. So a spirit of Jezebel will be someone that always excludes themselves from the rest, that will consider themselves a little bit better or more spiritual. That's dangerous. This is what Jezebel was doing. And then she was teaching them these deep secrets, which John actually says Satan's so-called deep secrets. And so a Jezebel spirit boasts deep understanding to God, which are actually understanding of God, which are actually satanically inspired, and manipulates through semi-true teaching, through sensuality, through deception, and through division. Guys, if we couldn't be easily deceived, deception wouldn't be Satan's main tool for us. We have to be on our guard. And that's one of the things Revelation brings up time and time again. It is easy to fall if you're not standing on the word, if you're not being vigilant. It's easy to fall to a Jezebel spirit who always wants to manipulate, dominate, control. And that can destroy your life. There are many women who have been totally destroyed by a man with, and I don't like to take it too far, but who would show a Jezebel spirit. So it's not like male or female, but often operates through a woman because there's a sensuality that can be attached to the Jezebel spirit. But this was a real person misleading her people. I don't know, when we look at all these external factors, I want to say, wow, we've got an amazing culture. It's so easy to be Christians today, right? Yeah. Okay, some internal church problems. And here I'm quickly going to look at three specific churches, but I'm going to be quick. And as you'll be pleased to know from last week, I have my timer on. So I have 14 minutes and 11 seconds left. The internal problems, so we looked at externals, was, first of all, an outwardly successful-looking church, the Church of Sardis. You can find this in chapter 3, verse 1 to 6. We don't have time to go through all these scriptures. I'm trying to give you a good summary. They were simply the church that put on a great show. I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. This was the church that had a brilliant sound system. You can see that in chapter 3, verse 7. It said, you have a brilliant sound system. You have impressive TED Talks. You have the most skilled musicians. You have the most incredible children's church. You have the best programs. You make sure that people can come in and out of church in 1 hour so that it doesn't inconvenience them. And if they are inconvenienced, you'll also have a choice and a pick of cappuccinos and Americanos. And you get my drift. Now, I'm not judging any of that. What I am saying is this. There is such a temptation, and it is prolific among Western churches. And even here in Cape Town, like every time I look on Facebook, there's some new special church that has just been planted. Now, we believe in planting church. We're not against that. But it's far easier to draw a crowd than to build a community. It's far easier to build massive people who come to an impressive 1 hour or 1.5 hour max program than it is to actually build a culture and a family and a community. It is far harder to do that. And so we have to be careful that we don't look for the bright and shiny. Yes, we want to be excellent. Yes, we want to have great preachers. That's already covered. Yes, we want to have, I saw Costa, yeah, that's why I said that's covered. We want to have those things are good. We want Corinth doing an amazing work with Children's Church. We want to have something that runs well. But the problem is, the litmus test that we use for a church that's going well is simply how big it is and simply how quickly it has grown. And it's good to grow quickly. It's good to be big. If it's something that God is doing, that is a revival, that God is on this person or these people, that is amazing. But the litmus test of always looking on the outside to see whether something is impressive, guys, that is not a church. It's a Kentucky Fried Chicken. I know that's an overstatement. Of course they're churches, but I love KFC. But I don't have to come up with the recipe. I don't have to think of the product. I don't have to, train my staff. I don't have to... I just pay... How much is it for a KFC franchise? I don't know, what? 6 million. And then everything's done for me, and I advertise, and it's a well-known product. I do not like that. I do not like well-known product churches that people simply come because it's been marketed well and it has a history somewhere else. I'm not against it, but I'm just saying, what are we building? Are we building a crowd or are we building a community? And what many people don't know is that we're in the back end of this, where I had one of the pastors in our fraternal come to me, and I'm not mentioning any names. He said when there was a church that arrived in this city, they basically recruited their worship pastor, their other pastor, all from other churches, tried to recruit all the people because they wanted to start with a crowd. And their litmus test was, how good a musician are you? I know of stories where worship leaders have got 21 minutes. This is a true story. Danny Stain actually told me this. They have 21 minutes with their in-ear to lead worship. And you cannot go over 21 minutes. Now, what are we doing? What are we building? Here's the thing. I love the way Jesus reveals himself to this church that has that has deeds and looks like it's being alive but is actually dead. Look what he says. And I'm paraphrasing. He says, I am the anointed one. These are the words of him who holds the seven spirits or the sevenfold spirit of God and the seven stars. Isn't that an indictment? He's saying, you look so good on the outside, but you're dead. Why? Because you don't have the anointing. You can't. Can I tell you what? Loud music, getting hyping up people, I can do that. That's not the anointing. People often say, well, such an anointed service. No, you just really like the worship and the songs, and there was a cool vibe. Yes, there is an anointing, but we're actually, as Mercy, we're after the anointing. Because otherwise, we turn into something where we're literally just trying to build up an excitement and a hype. No, we're a family who loves one another, but all we really want is the anointing, the Holy Spirit coming upon us in our gatherings. All right, 8 minutes left. The second church was the Church of Laodicea, and they were wealthy, and wealth, as it often does, but not always, brings arrogance. Do you know this is the only church that Jesus literally has nothing positive to say to? Imagine being the only church that's recorded in history, the one church that Jesus had nothing good to say about them. Based on a wealthy and important trade route, Laodicea. Look at chapter 3, verse 15. Every time I read this verse, I get a bit nervous because I'm like, oh man, that's me. So if you feel the same, welcome to the club. I know your deeds, not the rich part, the verse I'm about to read. I know your deeds, that you're neither cold nor hot. I wish you were neither one or the other. So because you're lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. You say I'm rich. I've acquired wealth and I don't need anything. You see, because being very wealthy protects you from a lot of things where you think your money is going to save you. Your son's going to court, done something wrong. Well, we can pay it. A little bit sick, like surgery that's going to cost millions, normal people couldn't afford. It's not a problem. Money can solve a lot of problems, and money is a blessing from God. But when the temptation of money is that I believe that money makes me independent of God and others. That's the temptation. This is what they're saying. I'm rich. I've acquired wealth and do not need a thing. By the way, we had an amazing December. Thank you so much for your tithes and offerings. It was the biggest income we've ever had as a church, a tithe income. But you guys obviously had a real bender holiday because January was low. So please just pay off those credit cards, pay off your debt from December, and sow that seed now. I'm just kidding. Anyway, okay. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, so you become rich, and white clothes to wear, which is about holiness, so you can cover your shameful nakedness and put salve on your eyes. In other words, wealth blinds us sometimes. He says, I want you to be able to see clearly. And look at the revelation of Jesus here. He says, basically, I'm in charge. Verse 14 says, the ruler. Hey, you think you're the ruler because you're wealthy and you got it all sorted out and don't need anything? No, I am the ruler of all creation. And then he says in verse 3:21, I am the true reward to the one who is victorious. I will give the right to sit on my throne, etc. So he's saying, you think you're wealthy, you think you got it all sorted out, but actually I am in control of this whole world. Secondly, the other way he reveals himself is, hey, remember that what you're living for is, and right now is going to die. Everything's going to be dead. Your money's going to go, but live for eternity and live for eternal rewards. The last church that had difficulty internally was intense persecution and poverty in Smyrna, and that's chapter 2 from verse 8 to 11. These guys have absolutely no criticism from Jesus. Let's be a church from Smyrna. And so, I'm going to go over this quickly. Jesus reveals himself in verse 8 as these are the words who are first and last, who died and came to life again. Be faithful even to the point of death. He who overcomes will not be hurt at all by the second death. Why does he reveal himself like that? Because people were absolutely getting martyred, murdered, persecutes it in Smyrna. And so he reveals himself as, hey, I know you lost your cousin last week to Domitian's sword, but remember, I am the resurrection and the life. Remember, you do not need to fear the second death because I have overcome. Remember that the gospel that we have is that Christians are raised again to a new heaven and a new earth. And so he starts the letter with, you're going through such difficulty. Remember, I am the resurrection and I am the life. And he talks about their afflictions and poverty. Don't you find it interesting that the one church that had absolutely nothing positive to say, that their crime or their problem, their difficulty was wealth and arrogance, and the one church that had, Jesus had, well, I think it's two, no criticism for, was the church of Smyrna. And look at what it says about it. I know your afflictions, verse 9 and 10, and your poverty, yet you're rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews, but are not Jews. And so don't you find that interesting? That in spite of all they're going through, no money, maybe no housing, one of the common things done to Christians in those days was a confiscation of property. How would you feel like about the house that you've had for 20 years? Oh, sorry, you're a Christian, we're taking that. Oh, sorry, you can't work here. How'd you feel? This is what they were living in. And so considering the pagan culture, considering everything the churches were facing in terms of the temples, immorality, the false teachings, the pretense, the rich and the poor, the persecution, now we can see why Jesus uniquely reveals himself specifically to each church differently. Summary, he reveals himself as holy to those who are struggling with immorality. He loves them enough to see the good, even though each church except one, he looks and says, I see what you're doing. The word for deeds or hard work is the Greek word kopos. It's where you get a blacksmith from striking. I see it. I see you. I see you. For those that are facing false teaching, he reveals himself as truth with the sword of the word coming out of his mouth. For those who think that they're the bee's knees, he talks about himself as the authority and power. The one, the Son of God, whose eyes are like blazing fire and whose feet are burnished bronze. For those suffering and dying, he reveals himself as the resurrection and the faithful ruler. Okay, I have 1 minute left. Let's talk about the rapture. Don't worry, it'll be quick. In chapter 3, verse 10, why I'm doing this separately at the end is, and all I'm going to do is explain the different views, then we're going to close. In chapter 3, verse 10, this is often taken by some Bible preachers or theologians as a reference to a church that is raptured. Now, if you don't know what rapture means, simply put, the church will be taken up from earth to be with God in heaven while the tribulations are poured out on the earth and people suffer. Okay? So Revelation 3 verse 10 says, since you have kept my commands to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. So the hour of trial coming on the whole world to test the inhabitants, you're going to be kept from. All right, so they would say that that would mean that that's saying to the church, they're not going to go through all those tribulations. They're going to be kept from it. God is going to snatch them away. All right? Just main views, the pre-tribulation rapture view is that believers will be raptured before the 7-year tribulation on the world. That the church is absent. There's a whole lot of scriptures there that are probably behind me. I'm not going to go through all of them. And the rapture and the second coming are separate events. And this is common in dispensational theology. The pre-tribulation rapture view, did you get that? Believers are raptured before the 7-year tribulation. The rapture and second coming are separate events. The mid-tribulation, the rapture happens through halfway through the tribulation, so after 3.5 years. And you can look at Daniel and the 70th week. There's some more scriptures there. Matthew 24, verse 15 to 21 says, the abomination of desolation marks the midpoint. If you've never heard that word, it's okay. We will get there. The third view is pre-wrath. So the rapture occurs late in the tribulation, before God's final wrath. Believers endure persecution by the Antichrist, but then they are rescued. Okay? There's some scriptures for that. Did you get that? So pre-wrath is that we go through some of it, that it's clinging the Antichrist, but then we will be rescued before the worst part. The post-tribulation is that the church endures the entire tribulation. The rapture and second coming are one event. The no separate rapture view, which is often held by an amillennial. If you don't know what I'm saying, don't worry. Amillennial or post-millennial view is that there is no rapture apart from Christ's final return. That end time language is often symbolic, that focuses on the resurrection and the final judgment. So there's pre-tribulation, you get taken out before it gets bad. There's mid-tribulation, you go halfway through it. There's pre-wrath, you go through most of it, but you get taken out for the worst. There's post, it's going to be a long 7 years because you'll be there. And the last, number five view would be simply that because of the symbolic language that we find in the book of Revelation, that there is no rapture, but that we will meet Christ in the air when he comes back at his final return. They don't separate the two. Okay. What I thought of doing for this series is to get, this is not a joke, to get people, just some chairs around the couch there afterwards, and there are some of you who love, who've got some great views on Revelation. We can maybe talk some more about it and the views. But I'm just giving you an introduction. Obviously, from next week, we're going to the hairy stuff from chapter 4. And interestingly enough, chapter 4, verse 1, where it says John is taken up into heaven, that's also interpreted as the rapture of the church. So I'm just stimulating your view. All right, won't you stand?